All right, so the last time we met, we were just beginning to talk about the cellular components of the inflammatory system. So, the very first ones that we had were white blood cells, also known as leukocytes. And the very first one of those we talked about was monocytes. And what's the fully mature version of a monocyte? It's a macrophage. And we use the analogy of a transformer. So, monocytes are the Autobot car form. Macrophages are the robot fighting form. Except, in the case of a monocyte macrophage, you can't go back. So once it transforms into that fighting form, it's done. That's what it's going to be for the rest of its life. Then we began to talk about the granulocytes. And the three granulocytes... Granulocytes were... neutrophils, which are the most common, and they are phagocytic like macrophages, but they can only eat 1 to 2 bacteria before they're dead. When there's purulent drainage or pus, the vast majority of pus is dead and dying neutrophils combined with the bacteria. And we also had to mention bands, which are immature neutrophils, and we learned about those already in antibiotics, so just to refresh your memory about the shift left, shift right, so bands become neutrophils. So when you have an increase in bands, we call that a shift to the left. Now, you can only use that terminology if there's an increased number of overall white blood cells. Fancy word for that was leukocytosis. Alright, so neutrophils, then we had eosinophils, and eosinophils they're named because they stain with a stain called eosin, but IgE is an antibody that gets its name from eosinophils because it binds to eosinophils. IgE, immunoglobulin E, E for eosinophil. And that makes it very, very highly, makes eosinophils highly related to allergic reactions, and then also helps to fight against parasites, so things like worms or malaria. A lot of times patients have allergic reactions, they'll have increased number of eosinophils, so like patients with asthma, for example. Then the last one was basophils. And basophils are also white blood cells, but the vast majority of basophils are not found in the blood. They're actually found in tissue, and we're not exactly sure all of their functions, but they seem to have a function in fighting funguses. So I think this is right where we left off last time. Is that right? Okay, so now new things. Next we have something that is called a mast cell. Now, mast cells are kind of interesting because they don't live in the blood. But we think that they were originally white blood cells. So we think they started off in the blood, produced in the bone marrow, and then they migrate out into the tissue where they live. So a mast cell can also receive IgE antibodies, and it can also degranulate when it's activated. So they've got these little granules in there that are filled with little bags of chemicals, and when it's stimulated, it's going to release those granules. So there's more than 17 different substances that are released by a mast cell when it degranulates. But the number one, about 40% of it, is histamine. Now, what does histamine do? How many have ever been stung by a bee? What happens? You swell up. Why do you swell up? Because of histamine. How many of you have allergies and you take an antihistamine? Well, what does that antihistamine do? It blocks the effects of histamine. So, histamine is a cytokine. Remember we talked about that word earlier. A cytokine is any chemical that alters the behavior of a cell. So, in this case, histamine is a cytokine that causes vasodilation, and it causes increased membrane permeability, and it's also going to sensitize nociceptors, which is actually not going to be perceived as pain in this case. It's going to be perceived usually as itching. So that's why antihistamines have an anti-itching property. So we'll talk a little bit more about first and second generation antihistamines a little while later when we talk about drugs. But for now, histamine is about 40% of what a mast cell releases. Now, why do histamines not really work that well? Well, because 60% is other stuff. So there's an enormous number of inflammatory mediators. And one of the things that you have to understand about the immune system and inflammation is that it's incredibly complicated. And we're just talking about some brief little spots. So we're sketching, and we're doing the big things, and we're trying not to get lost in too many nitty-gritty details. And you're like, really? You're being incredibly detailed, Dr. Heyman. But in fact, I'm not really. It's just, that's what the immune system is. Welcome to nursing. So those are mast cells. Then we also have natural killer cells. Now, natural killer cells are kind of interesting because they are also considered part of the immune system, but they aren't really immune. Anyway, so they can come from either lymphocytic tissue, or they can come from what's called myelogenous tissue. I haven't mentioned those words yet, have I? All right, quick little primer on how blood is made. We start off with what's called a pluripotent stem cell. What does pluripotent mean? Plural. None of you know English, okay. What's plural mean? Many. Many, potent. Ability. So it can become anything. It can become many things. So that pluripotent stem cell can become all different kinds of blood cells. And you guys should have learned this in A&P, right? Right? Hematopoiesis? What? So, this then is going to turn into either a myelogenous precursor, or progenitor, I believe is the correct term, or a lymphocytic precursor. And the myelogenous can in turn become, eventually, through a series of steps, red blood cells, monocytes, all of your different granulocytes, all three types we just talked about, and mast cells, and platelets, and then over here you got, and natural killer cells. And then over here you've got lymphocytes, which are three different types. And then, natural killer cells too. So natural killer cells are interesting because they come from both sides of your pluripotent stem cell tree. Now, this is not going to be on your test, but it might help you to understand the overall process. Say it again? Red blood cells, monocytes. Monos. Yeah. So, red blood cells, monocytes, granulocytes, I can't even read that one myself, mast cells, platelets, and natural killer cells are all myelogenous. And then, I actually have a slide on this in the PowerPoint, so you can just reference that. And then, lymphocytes come from the lymphocytic precursor, or progenitor, and natural killer cells come from both. I feel like I'm repeating myself, because I am. Now, natural killer cells have an innate ability to kill cells that are infected with either viruses, or to be able to kill cancer cells. So they kind of do a little bit of inflammation and a little bit of immunity at the same time. Then we have a cell called a dendritic cell. Now, dendritic cells are a really interesting case because they were discovered back in the 1970s, but they didn't really show up in your textbooks for pathophysiology and nursing and A&P until the mid-2000s. So it was like a 40-year time span in between the time that they were discovered and then when you guys had to start learning about them. Now, how many of you have ever heard of something called Langerhans cells? Langerhans? Yeah. Named after Dr. Langerhans, who discovered them. What are they? We actually mentioned them last time when we talked about macrophages. deer in the headlights. I got nothing. But you said you'd heard of them. No, actually, Haman. What I said I'd heard of was Isles of Langerhans. What are those? Oh.
They're in the pancreas?
They're in the pancreas! And it's where your beta cells that secrete insulin live. Well, Dr. Langerhans also discovered some cells that became named after him that live in the skin. And macrophages that live in the skin are called Langerhans cells. But it turns out that there's another kind of cell that lives in the skin that is also called Langerhans cells, and those are dendritic cells. So a dendritic cell was so named because they are shaped kind of like this. And so the guy who discovered them said, well, it looks kind of like dendrites from a neuron. So he named them dendritic cells, which have nothing to do with nervous tissue. Go figure. So the dendritic cell is also a cell that came from that pluripotent stem cell on the myelogenous side. And it has a couple properties. One is it's phagocytic, so it can eat nearby cells. And it is also what is called macropinocytic. Now, how many of you are familiar with a whale?
A whale.
Like, do you know whale? Your inner channel, your inner Dory. Okay. So how does a whale eat? It opens its mouth and it sucks in an enormous amount of seawater, and then it closes its mouth, and then there's these little ridges called baleen, and it goes and it squirts the water out, and whatever's left in behind it eats. And what kind of food is that? Oh, look, krill. Plankton and krill. So, it's going to eat them that way. So, that's what these do, is it sucks in a whole bunch of the nearby extracellular fluid, and then it filters it out to see if there's anything that it might have missed. And then, once it's eaten something, it's going to process it. And it's going to chop it up into little pieces, and it's going to go, that tastes healthy. That tastes okay. That tastes like normal stuff. That's bad. I got to do something about this. And when it discovers something bad, it's going to travel through the lymph to the nearby lymph node, where it's going to start asking lymphocytes, do you recognize this antigen? Do you recognize this? Do you recognize this? And it's going to try and activate T cells. Now, when you took ANP2, or maybe it was ANP1, you talked about the immune system. What was it that activated T cells? Dead silence. No, this is where you tell me something. Nope. I'm pretty sure you did not learn that. Good guess. Usually we say macrophages. How many of you heard that? Macrophages activate T cells. You ever heard that? Yeah, you heard that? You heard that? No? Only one of you heard that? The rest of you were in a different ANP2 class? So that's often what we're taught. But as it turns out, that's not really the case. Now, if you put macrophages in a test tube along with T cells, they will activate them. But in your body, it turns out, most of the time, what activates a T cell is a dendritic cell. So dendritic cells activate T cells and start the entire immune process. Without dendritic cells, we don't have an immune response. All right. These are the cellular components of inflammation. And then we have some chemical components. So the first one we're going to talk about is something called complement. That's a lovely sweater you've got there, Ariana. Huh? I said that's a lovely sweater you've got there, Ariana.
Thank you.
But that's not what we're talking about, is it? When you pay a compliment to someone, how would you spell that? with an I. And if you got something for free from a hotel, that would be considered complimentary with an I also. So what does it mean when we have an E? Complement. They work together. Maybe you should think of Jerry Maguire. You complete me. You had me at hello. So, in this case, complement is going to complete or help the inflammation process do its thing. So, there's two things we need to know about complement. The first one is, how is the complement cascade... It's a series of enzymes that activate one another. That's why it's called a cascade. The reason for that is because this very dangerous process, and it can cause an enormous amount of harm to whatever it attaches to. So you don't want it just randomly activating in your bloodstream. You really want it to be activated in a certain spot at a certain time. So that's why you have the safeguard of a series of enzymes that activate each other. That's called a cascade. In this case, the complement cascade. So, the first thing is, how is this complement cascade activated in the first place? And as it turns out, there are three pathways. How many?
Three.
So the first one, interestingly enough, is called classical. And it involves complement cascade 1, C1, binding to something. And as it turns out, there are three somethings it could be. So the first thing it could be is an antigen-antibody complex. Now, what is an antigen?
Anything that stimulates
an immune response. That is a very good answer. It's slightly technically not correct, but it's good enough for us. Technically, it's anything you can produce an antibody against. So, what is an antibody? It's a little component of your immune system that attacks antigens. And it's kind of circular when you define it that way, isn't it? But who cares? That's how we do it. So, when an antibody binds to an antigen, that is called an antigen-antibody complex. And antigen-antibody complexes, C1 can bind to that. And then that activates the complement cascade. The second thing it can bind to is something that is called C-reactive protein, also known as CRP for short. Now, what is the major source of proteins in your body? The major factory of proteins? It's your liver. So where does C-reactive protein come from? Your liver. Now, does your liver produce it all the time or just sometimes? Well, I don't think you'd be asking the question if the answer were all the time, so I'm going to go with sometimes. Okay, great answer and good thinking. Now, the most important question is, when does your liver produce it? Since you got the first answer right, smarty pants.
Not me.
Not me, I was in the smarty pants, don't look at me. You know the absolute best way to volunteer? Make eye contact. Now, I see a couple of you like, I will never make eye contact again. Well, hold on, I'm telling a joke here. So, the second best way to volunteer, you know what it is? Avoid eye contact. Okay, go ahead and ask your question.
Do we have an infection?
That's close. Now, what did we say inflammation was? What's the definition of it? The response to injury. And what was the descriptor that we used for inflammation? No, those are signs and symptoms. What's the description of the overall process? Starts with an I.
Immune response?
No. Does it start with an I? Now I'm having a hard time thinking about that. This is what happens when you get old. You forget stuff. It starts with an N.
An N?
An N.
Defect.
And the second letter is O. And the third letter is N again. Non. You guys are good. You can spell out loud. Non-specific. All right, so inflammatory processes are non-specific. What does that mean? It means it doesn't matter what kind of injury, it'll always happen the same. So, let me ask you this, Ashley.
Yes.
Did your body produce C-reactive protein during infection?
Yes.
Only infection or other times too?
Non-specific.
It's non-specific. So what would be a better answer?
Non-specific.
Yeah. When does your body produce C-reactive protein?
Whenever you
do non-specific what?
Inflammation.
Yeah, so any inflammation, your body, your liver specifically, will start producing C-reactive protein. So C-reactive protein is sometimes what is known as an acute phase protein. So during the acute phase of inflammation, your body will produce C-reactive protein. Now, little sidebar for PathoPharm 2. When we get to cardiovascular diseases, atherosclerosis is when your arteries build up goo in the middle, right? Well, in the middle, inside the artery. And that can eventually lead to strokes and heart attacks. As it turns out, in order to have the atherosclerosis process occur, you need inflammation of the artery. But it's a very small, tiny amount of inflammation. And if you use a regular CRP test, you can't even tell that it's there. So when you're trying to detect cardiovascular inflammation, you use what is known as highly sensitive CRP. And that is, if that is high, it's a potential sign that the patient has arterial inflammation, which is leading to atherosclerosis. That will not be on your test, so you can erase it out of your memory now, until you get to PathoPharm 2, in which case you'll have to bring it back. But C-reactive protein, not only is it something that can activate the complement cascade, it's also something we can measure to see if there's inflammation present. Does that make sense? So, when is C-reactive protein produced, Ashley?
White blood cells.
No, when?
In the liver.
When?
When there's non-specific inflammation.
When there's inflammation. You can just say inflammation. So... No, you said infection. Yep, that's what I meant too on the test. So, make sure you're using the right words. I know I don't always use them the right way, but on the test I still expect you to use the right way. So, when does it occur?
When is
inflammation. And not only does it activate C1, but we can use it as a lab value. And we can check CRP levels. If they're high, what does that mean?
Inflammation is present.
What kind of inflammation? Can't tell. What kind?
Can't tell.
Yeah. You got to do the hand motions in the face, or it doesn't work. You won't remember it otherwise. All right, so that is the second one. And then the third one is it can actually bind directly to some pathogens, primarily bacteria. So, if C1 is binding to something, that is considered what pathway?
Classical.
The classical pathway. And what are the three things it can bind to?
To antibodies,
C-reactive
protein,
and
directly.
Directly to what?
Pathogen.
To a pathogen. Alright. The second thing, the second pathway, is called the mannose binding lectin pathway. So, mannose is a sugar that is found in the cell walls of some bacteria. And during inflammation, your liver produces something called mannose binding lectin. A lectin is a protein. So it's a protein that can bind to the sugar that's only found in
bacteria.
And so if it binds to something, you know it's a bacteria, right? And if the bacteria shouldn't be in that spot, then you know you should kill it. So that's what happens there. Now, when does your body produce mannosmining lectin? So when?
When there's a non-specific...
You don't have to say that word. That's not. Inflammation.
Yeah.
So anytime there's inflammation, your body will produce mannose-binding lectin. What kind of protein does that make mannose-binding lectin? An acute phase protein. And then the third pathway is called the alternative pathway or spontaneous. And this is when it just occurs in the blood spontaneously. And this is very, very dangerous because this can lead to inappropriate immune responses or inflammatory responses. So, three pathways. Classical, mannose-binding lectin, and spontaneous, or alternative. The classical has three sub-pathways. C1 is going to bind to the antigen antibody, C-reactive protein, or directly. Now, that's the first thing you need to know about complement. How is it activated? The second thing you need to know is, what the heck does it do? Well, it complements. Okay. So, let's talk about the three ways that it complements the inflammatory response. So the very first thing it does is it increases inflammation. The second thing that it does is that it can actually kill some bacteria. Would you like to know how?
Yes.
Oh, me too. How many of you have ever seen this little plastic device, like a little plastic tube with some like little cut out holes in it, and you're supposed to like screw it into an orange and then you can drink out of the orange?
Oh, yeah.
What did we say about bacterial cell walls in the last chapter for antibiotics? What was the purpose of that bacterial cell wall? To prevent something. What was the something?
Lysis.
Why would a bacteria just lyse if it didn't have a cell wall? Because it's hypertonic. So if you poke a hole in the cell wall, to quote Chaucer from A Knight's Tale, it's entrails become extrails. Actually, it wasn't Chaucer. That's what the other guy threatened Chaucer to do. Have you guys seen A Knight's Tale? You've never seen A Knight's Tale? Do you know who Heath Ledger is?
Yeah.
He's in that. Oh, okay, I'll watch it now. I've been alive longer than you have, so that's part of it. But you should watch A Knight's Tale. It's a very good movie. You guys don't get the jokes at all anymore. It's okay. So... Yeah, well, at least you knew the little device that doesn't work when you screw it into the orange, but hey. So, here's a bacteria, and what we do is we create this little series of proteins that goes down into the cell wall and forms like a little straw, and it pokes holes into it. And then it lets the gut spill out. So it punctures the cell wall, allowing the guts to come out, killing some weaker bacteria. Now, this little thing that does that is called the MAC, the membrane attack complex. So, what's responsible for killing the bacteria? The MAC, which stands for membrane attack complex. And how does it work? It pokes holes into the membrane, to the cell wall, allowing the guts to spill out. And to quote a movie you haven't seen, it's entrails become extrails. All right, and the third thing that it does is it opsonizes. Now, that was interesting. I don't even see what kind of... Oh, nah, nope. It's just dark now. Hello, darkness, my old friend. Okay. So, opsonize. This one can be a little bit difficult if you're not familiar with military hardware. But there's a kind of a guided missile that requires someone to point a laser at the target. It's called a laser-guided missile. Bet you didn't see that one coming. Mm-mm. So, what you do is you've got someone who's got a little laser pointer, and they point their little laser at whatever the target is. And when the laser hits the target, the missile can see that, and it's going to hit it. It doesn't actually see the laser. What it sees is when the laser breaks up by hitting the object. Does that make sense? Doesn't. You guys don't care. The process of hitting the target with a laser is called painting the target. So as long as you're pointing the laser at someone, what are you doing with them? You're painting them with a laser. You're marking them to be destroyed by that missile. Does that make sense? Okay. When you've got this bacteria that's got this little Mac sticking out of it, that is a signal to macrophages that they should come over and eat it. So it's kind of like it's been marked, but instead of with a laser, it's been marked with what? A Mac. So the Mac paints that cell as a target to be destroyed by macrophages. So the macrophages, which are kind of big, dumb, and ugly, oh, okay, I'll come and eat this thing. Does that make sense? Well, it's just a protein, so it gets broken down into amino acids again and recycled or pooped out or whatever. Yeah. Not part of our problem. So, this process of painting a cell to be eaten by a macrophage is called opsonize. And the thing that does the opsonizing is called an opsonin. So what is the opsonin in this case? Not the macrophage. What does the painting, not the eating? The Mac. Yeah, the membrane attack complex. I see how that could be a little confusing. The Mac does the macrophage. Okay, whatever. So those are the three things that complement cascade does. Does that make sense? So what are the two things you need to know about complement cascade? How it's activated, the three pathways, one of them has three sub-pathways, and what do, no matter which pathway starts, in the end, these are the three things that it does. Does that make sense? Alright. There are quite a few autoimmune diseases that are caused by inappropriate activation of complement cascade, typically from the antibody-antigen complex. And we'll talk all about those when we talk about allergic reactions. So, at this time, we only have one more thing that we need to talk about for the chemical component, and that is a chemical called tumor necrosis factor alpha. Now, originally it was called tumor necrosis factor alpha. I am not aware of any betas or gammas personally, but what I can tell you is that lately there's been a trend toward just calling it tumor necrosis factor, or TNF, without the alpha. But since I'm old school, I'm saying alpha. Whatevs. You don't care. Now, tumor necrosis factor alpha is a cytokine. What does a cytokine do? What is a cytokine? It's a chemical that alters the behavior of a cell. Right. Okay, so in this case, it's going to do three particular things. The first thing is it's going to cause vasodilation. Does that sound familiar when it comes to inflammation? Yes, we want to get more blood to the damaged area, so therefore you have to vasodilate. So far, so good. The next thing it does is it causes increased membrane permeability. Does that sound familiar? Yes. In order to get complement cascade and antibodies to the damaged area, you need to increase the membrane permeability so they can leak out of the blood into the damaged tissue. So far, so good. The third thing that it does is that it increases clotting. Now, does that make a lot of sense to you? You might have damaged blood vessels, and clotting off those damaged blood vessels might be a good thing. Okay. As it turns out, macrophages secrete tumor necrosis factor alpha during inflammation. And it makes a lot of sense in terms of that damaged area needs these things to happen. But there's a problem. What happens when the bacteria escapes out of that damaged tissue into the bloodstream? Now what happens? What happens to that little bacteria? I'm free! So it's floating around in the blood, bopping around, and eventually it goes through an organ. Are there some organs that are responsible for filtering your blood? What are they? Say again? Lymph nodes are lymph. Kidneys do filter your blood, but they're not meant to filter out cells. So, the spleen. Now give me another one. Spleen's over here. And one over here too. The liver. So, the spleen has a huge number of macrophages in it, and your liver has macrophages in it that are called, we named these last time. Oh, man. Kupffer cells. And those macrophages in your liver and in your spleen begin to go, hey, there's bacteria in the blood. And they start to secrete their tumor necrosis factor. But where do they secrete it? Instead of into the damaged tissue, now they're secreting it into the blood. So now you get vasodilation all over the body. What does that do to your blood pressure? Vasodilation all over the body. What does that do to your blood pressure? So that decrease it. In fact, if it decreased it too much, what could that lead to? Shocking. What kind of shock would that mimic where you have vasodilation? Neurogenic shock. So how might you treat that? What do you want to do? You want to vasoconstrict. What's the fancy name for a drug that causes vasoconstriction? We haven't said this word yet in class, so we'll just see how smart you are just generally now. Okay, vaso, good. What's the word when you push on something? Another word, if you push a button, would be another way to say that. Press. Vasopressors. Ors. Vasopressors. So drugs that cause vasopression or vasoconstriction are called vasopressors. And name two vasopressors that you are aware of. You had to do this just on the last test, by the way. What receptor is responsible for vasoconstriction and the sympathetic response? Alpha 1. All right, now name two alpha 1 stimulators. I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Okay, I still can't hear you, I'm sorry. That is an alpha 1 blocker, not a stimulator. Okay, phenylephrine is a good answer. Pseudoephedrine, not so much. That's more for your nose. Phenylephrine for your nose too, but it can also be given IV for this purpose. I was going to say catecholamines, including dopamine and norepinephrine. So, treatment for a patient who's got this problem would be phenylephrine, dopamine, and norepinephrine. Not all three at the same time, please. Increased membrane permeability. What is that going to do?
It
allows white blood cells and, more importantly, proteins. But when the proteins exit, what does that do to a certain kind of pressure? What kind of pressure would that be called? It's not hydrostatic pressure. Is it?
Osmotic pressure.
So it decreases the osmotic pressure. And that allows what symptom to occur? Edema. Now, where is the edema occurring? Everywhere. So you actually have edema systemically. And water that's in edema is water that's not in your blood, so that is actually going to decrease your blood volume. And what kind of... could that lower your blood pressure? Yeah, it could lower your blood pressure. And what kind of shock might that simulate? Hypovolemic shock. So, by the way, if you haven't figured it out yet, this is how septic shock occurs. Bacteria escape into the blood. They get filtered in the spleen and the liver, which the macrophages there secrete tumor necrosis factor alpha, which causes these effects. And that's how your patient ends up in septic shock. Now, so what is the ultimate cure for septic shock? Antibiotics, you got to get rid of the bacteria in the blood. But the patient is probably going to die before you do that. So to keep them alive along the way, you're going to treat their neurogenic looking shock with alpha 1 or vasopressors. You're going to treat their hypovolemic looking shock with increased fluids. And then we got to deal with this problem right here. Increased clotting. Now, where is the clotting going to occur?
Everywhere.
So what's a fancy word for saying spread out? Now, you're never going to guess. So I'll just tell you. Disseminate. Yeah. So the word literally means to cast seed or spread seed. Like in the old days, like in the Bible, there was a man who was casting seed, and some of it fell on the path, and some of it fell on the good ground, and you remember that? Yeah, anyway. So, in this case, we're going to spread the clotting throughout the entire body. So, the fancy word for that is disseminated. Yeah. Helps we know how to spell. Disseminate. Like these wrong. Disseminated. Now, what's the word for inside a blood vessel? What was the word for inside?
Intra.
And what's the word for vessel?
Is it
no, it's not. But that wouldn't have made you less wrong if you just said the answer outright. So intra... vascular. Oh yeah. So vascular means of blood vessels or of vessels. And then what's a fancy word for clot?
Thrombus.
That's a very good fancy word, but let's think of a different fancy word. Starts with a C. It's kind of like congeal. Coagulate. Yeah, I knew that was what it was. Sure you did.
I'm bad at pronouncing, but
I believe that. So, if you take the first letter of each word, what do you get? D-I-C.
I wasn't
going to
say it.
Yeah, I know. That one is way too hard, Dr. Riemann. Yeah, this is not an acronym. It is a abbreviation. So what's an acronym? That's when the first letter, that's when an abbreviation forms a new word. So like laser, light amplification stimulation by the emission of, no. Light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. L-A-S-E-R. Laser. Bet you didn't know that, did you? You don't know laser? You've never seen that movie either, have you?
Yeah,
no, okay, fine. At least you know one movie. Melody's like, nope. Got nothing. All right. So it's not DICK, which would be an acronym. It's D-I-C. It's an abbreviation. So, D-I-C is a problem that happens when you have septic shock. And so you're going to have clotting inside the blood vessels spread out through the entire body. And that's going to cause two problems. The first one is clotting. Is clotted blood thicker or thinner than regular blood? Thicker. So it's going to cause the viscosity of blood to go up slightly, which makes it harder for your heart to pump the blood around. Imagine trying to pump toothpaste instead of water. You know, you get the idea. It's not that bad. It doesn't turn into toothpaste, but slightly thicker than regular blood. That's not a huge problem, though. The big problem is, when you do you have enough clotting cascade and fibrinogen and platelets to clot everywhere all at once? No. So what happens to your clotting material when you're trying to clot everywhere all at once? You got nothing? Well, let's not skip to the end. So, you start to clot everywhere, but you don't have enough clotting material to go around. So what happens? All right, let's use a different analogy. If you want, right this moment, can you go out to a store and get toilet paper? Yeah. But if everyone went out at the exact same time to get toilet paper, what would happen? No toilet paper left, right? They run out. Okay. How many of you have been hurt during a hurricane? What happens? You go to the store and there's like nothing. There's no bread, there's no eggs, there's no ice, there's nothing in the store. Why is that? Because there's not enough food in the store for everyone all at once. So what happens? The store runs out. You try and clot everywhere all at once, but you don't have enough clotting material for all at once. So your body runs out. Then what happens? No, not yet. Don't kill your patient just yet. What's going to happen before they die? If you can't clot, you bleed. So, patients with DIC bleed to death. They're going to be hemorrhaging from everywhere. You start off clotting, and then you run out of clotting factors. So, if you've ever seen a movie where they have a hemorrhagic fever like the hot zone or outbreak, this is what happens when they all start bleeding to death. So, these patients are going to be bleeding out of their eyes, out of their nose, out of their mouth, out of the IV site. They're going to be bleeding everywhere. Now, to keep this patient alive long enough for the antibiotics to work, vasopressors, fluids, and now we've got to replace clotting factors and platelets. How do we replace clotting factors, do you think? Okay, well, we will give blood because they're going to be losing blood. Okay. All right. But how can we replace the clotting factors themselves? What part of blood do clotting factors live in? Well, it's not the cell part. What's the water part called? Plasma. So, if we take some fresh plasma and we freeze it, what do we get? Fresh, frozen plasma. So, to keep the patient with this alive, DIC-induced hemorrhage, you're going to give, first of all, packed red blood cells, PRBCs, and you're also going to give them fresh, frozen plasma, which is going to have clotting factors in it. And they might also need platelets as well. Now, patients with DIC will sometimes have 20 units of each of these a day. And they could be in DIC for multiple days. So one single patient can be using up 60 units per day, you know, 20 of each one, just to keep that patient alive for one day. So, how many of you gave blood when the blood mobile was here the other day? None of you?
They turned
you away. You can't give blood. Such excuses. If you were a hero, that's what the shirt says. Anyway, if you had given blood, you would have had to have 19 of your other fellow students go with you just to provide one day of one patient on DIC. So these patients are, there's a song that describes their situation, knocking on heaven's door. Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door. No, the song is old now. It's from the 50s, you know, Bob Dylan. And then Eric Clapton sang it, and then Guns N' Roses sang it, but you guys were born after Guns N' Roses were popular. Ask your parents about Guns N' Roses. All right. So anyway, these patients are going to die unless we do something heroic. We've got to treat their shock, treat their shock, treat their shock, and treat their bleeding. Does that make sense? So, septic shock is caused by TNF-alpha run amok. How do you spell amok? All right, well, there's two amoks. The amok you want is M-A-M-O-K. If you spell run amok, M-U-C-K, that's like you're running into mud, which is not the same as running around crazy, killing people you shouldn't be killing, which is amok. So, TNF-alpha, tremendous power for good under the right circumstances. What are those right circumstances? You got nothing? Where do we want TNF-alpha to be released?
In the blood.
No! That's what causes this. Into damaged tissues. You're like, I told you nursing school makes you dumber. It's already happening. So, TNF-alpha gets released into damaged tissues. Good. So you can think of TNF-alpha as Spider-Man. But with great responsibility. Sorry, with great power comes great responsibility. And you can think of TNF-alpha in the bloodstream as Venom. He wants to be a hero, but he's really a villain. Right? Yeah, you guys didn't watch that Venom movie, did you? Yeah. Well, I heard it was terrible, so I haven't seen it either, but... See, you don't know the new movies either. Ha! Okay, so, TNF-alpha in your tissues, good. TNF-alpha in the blood, bad. Causes septic shock. What are the three components of septic shock? Vasodilation, increased permeability, and DIC, which leads to
hemorrhage.
To treat that, you need
all of that.
Packed red blood cells, fresh frozen plasma, and platelets. Up to 20 units a day, or sometimes even more. So, these patients are enormously expensive to keep alive. But we can do it. We have the technology. And you guys don't understand that because it's from the Bionic Man, which was in the 70s. Okay. Sorry, it's okay. If only you knew your pop culture. All right. So, on that note, we are now done with the components of the inflammatory system. And we are going to move over to this side of the board. And we are going to talk about the immune system. Now, what was the single word that was the best word to use to describe inflammation?
Nonspecific.
So over here, when we describe immune, we should use what word? Specific. All right, smarty pants. Specific to what? Nope. Nope. Closer. Antigens. Okay, so when we're talking about specific, we're specific to antigens. So let's talk just a moment about antigen. Now, earlier you had said that an antigen is anything you produce an immune response to. And technically, that's called an immunogen. So, is there a difference between immunogens and antigens? So, close enough. Now, immunogens or antigens are multi-part. So, it's the same theory that we use to describe the interaction of a receptor and a drug, or a hormone and a receptor. And what is that theory? Lock and key. So imagine for a moment that you had an antigen that looked like this. Okay. Now, how many is one antigen? But how many potential antibodies could we make against this thing?
Three.
One that recognizes triangles, one that recognizes circles, and one that recognizes triangles, or ears, eyes, and noses. So there's three potential antibodies that can bind to this one antigen. So this antigen is called multivalent. How many of you ever heard that term before? You heard it?
Yeah.
All right. Sometime, how many of you got your flu shot this flu shot season? What word is used to describe your flu shot? It's usually trivalent. What does that mean? Three different strains of virus. So you can produce three different kinds of antibodies against that one thing. There's also a quadrivalent, which means you can produce four. So four different strains, four different kinds of antibodies. So this is called multivalent. Now, the exact portion of the antigen that you can produce the antibody against, the part that would bind to the antibody, that is called the epitope. Epitope. T-O-P-E. Now, if you separate out the epitope from the rest of the antigen, then what's left over is called a hapten. Now, let's apply this newfound knowledge to penicillins and cephalosporins. What was the portion that people are actually allergic to? The beta-lactam portion. Maybe. So, maybe not. But they have this little structure in common. So this is might be a hapten or it might be an epitope. We don't know. Does that make sense? Maybe for some people it's an epitope. Maybe for other people it's a hapten. But either way, there's something in common between cephalosporins and penicillins that allows them to cross-react. So that's the same principle as our bunny, which now looks more like a panda? Anyway. It was a cat, but now it looks more like a bear. That's what happens when you put a circle around the nose. Yeah. Okay. So, back up to here now. The cells of the immune system are going to be specific to epitopes, or more generally, to antigens. And each of them is only going to be able to recognize or bind to one single antigen, or more specifically, one specific epitope. Does that make sense? Okay, now, I'll give you a hint. The cells on this side are all called lymphocytes. So where do the lymphocytes come from? Where are blood cells made? In the bone marrow! All right. From what? I wrote it on the board earlier. Pluripotent stem cell becomes a lymphocytic progenitor, and then eventually down to the different types of lymphocytes. Remember that? No, it doesn't matter. I said it wasn't going to be on your test anyway. Just seeing if you're paying attention. So, you guys are conserving your energy, your mental energy, by not memorizing things that aren't on the tests. I can appreciate that. So, lymphocytes. There's multiple types of lymphocytes. Now, they all come from the bone marrow. But some of them grow up in the bone marrow. They stay home. And we call these B cells. B for bone. Others of them go off to college in the thymus gland. And we call these T cells. T for thymus. So we're going to talk about T cells first. Now, how many of you are in college right now? None of you? Oh, okay. Two of you. Okay. Why did you go to college?
To learn.
To learn. I'm just here to learn, everybody.
To get an education.
To get an education. To get a degree. To make the big bucks. To have choices in life. That's why you chose nursing, right? Because you can go anywhere and get a job anywhere, and if you get bored of one job, you can get a different kind of job, and you can do all these flexible things, and you got choices. So, when you go to college, what do you get?
Choices.
And in the case of a T cell, it has two choices. It can become either a manager or a secret agent. Now, what does a secret agent do? I have no idea. What's a secret agent? Okay. How many have ever heard of communism? The Soviet Union? Okay. Nazi Germany. Now, in each of those areas, there were certain people whose job it was to look at the citizens of the country and see if they were rebelling or had rebellious thoughts against the regime. What? Kind of like a spy, but instead of spying on other countries, you're spying on your own people. So in the case of Germany, they were called the Gestapo. And in the case of the Nazis, well, partly KGB. KGB did both. They did internal and external spying. So what was the job of the secret agent under those countries? To spy on their own people, right? To see if they were turning to the dark side. Now, can cells in your body turn to the dark side and attack your own body in some way? Yes? Really? What kind? Under what circumstances? Okay, well, let's not say autoimmune disease, because that's the problem with this itself. So let's say cancer. All right, so cancer is one of your own cells mutates on you and starts trying to take over the whole body. Right? What's another situation where a cell can turn to the dark side and start working against your own body? What happens if there's a little thing called a virus? What does virus do? What do viruses do? I mean, you all got right that HIV is an infectious etiology, right? So what do they do? What does a virus do? How does it replicate? It has to infect a cell inside your body. We call it a host cell. And then it takes over the cell and turns that cell into a little virus factory. So the two major ways that our cells turn to the dark side, one is cancer and the other is viral infections. So secret agent cells, their job is to check out your body cells and go, are you going to become cancer? Are you virally infected? And if they are, what does it do? Kills it. So, what's the fancy word for cell? Site. What's the fancy word for kills or dangerous to? Toxic. Put those together, what do you get? Cytotoxic. How many of you ever heard that before? cytotoxic. My pen is running out of dry erase magic. This is not technology, it's magic. It's okay. Oh yeah, I only have pink. Hold on. Oh, right! Oh, yeah! Ninja-like reflexes. Okay, so secret agents are called cytotoxic cells. Now, to give the secret agent its... If you were a policeman, what would you... How would you know someone was a policeman? A uniform, but you can buy uniforms at Halloween stores. A badge! So we're going to give these cells badges. It's a special protein that lives on the cell membrane, and that special badge is called CD8. Wow, that's dark! It's like this magic is strong. Okay, so CD8 is a protein that's on the outside of the membrane of these cells, and identifies them as cytotoxic cells. Now, the CD8 protein is not just for show. It's actually a receptor. So, in order to be able to examine your body's cells have a special protein called major histocompatibility complex, MHC. And there's two types of MHC. So, every cell that has a nucleus, what's inside a nucleus, by the way? DNA. What is the purpose of DNA? It's the instructions for what? Close. It's the instructions on how to make proteins. It's blueprints. So every cell with DNA has the potential to do what? Make proteins. So as it's making proteins, what it's going to do is it's going to display those proteins on this special molecule called MHC1, Major Histocompatibility Complex 1. Every cell in your body has MHC1 if it has a nucleus. And so our CD8 cell, the CD8, has the ability to bind to MHC1. And that's how the cell is able to look. So, let's say that N means normal proteins. So the CD8 cell comes along and it says, hey, what kind of protein are you making there? And it goes, normal proteins. It's not exactly how it works, but you get the idea, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And then the cell goes, okay, CD8 cell, keep going. Carry on, do whatever you're doing. But if this CD8 cell recognizes, let's say it's producing noses. So this is a virus, not a bacteria now. So if it's producing noses and this can detect noses, then it goes, you're evil. You've turned to the dark side. You're an angry elf. You must die! And it tells the thing to die. Now, what's a fancy word for telling a cell to die? Starts with an A. Apoptosis. Some people will say it apoptosis, but, you know, what's a ptosis among friends? So, apoptosis. So, this cell will tell it to commit suicide, and if it doesn't commit suicide, it actually has the ability to kill it itself. That's why it's called cytotoxic. Now, CD8 cells are responsible for doing this and seeing if it's producing abnormal proteins. Cancer cells sometimes produce abnormal proteins, so it can kill cancer cells. And if it's got virally infected proteins, if that CD8 cell can detect that particular kind of protein, that epitope, it'll tell it to kill itself. Does that make sense? Okay. Now, what if the cell has the wrong kind of MHC? Then what happens? So, I can't even tell what kind of protein you're making because your MHC is all wrong. What do you think it would do?
They would naturally kill it.
Could that be a problem? Well, how could that be a problem? What kind of person would that be a problem for? Someone with a transplant. We take someone else's organ who has a different MHC and we put it into your body. And now your CD8 cells come along to see what kind of proteins it's making, and it's like, wait a minute, this is all wrong. You got the wrong MHC here, buddy. I gotta kill you. And it destroys the organ. So to prevent that from happening, what would we need to do to a patient who's had a transplant? Okay, we can give them an immunosuppressant. Now, before we even do the transplant, what else could we do? What we want to do is we want to find a good match. What does that mean? We do genetic testing, and we're going to see how similar or far apart the MHC is. So patients who have more similar MHC are going to have less severe, they call it transplant rejection, or transplant graft rejection. People who have very dissimilar MHC are more likely to have stronger and faster rejection reactions. So, in addition to issues with cancer and with viral infected cells, CD8 is also responsible for transplant rejection. All right. So that is secret agents. Now, what's the other thing that we said that a T cell could choose in life? Nope. The B cells stayed at home in the bone. T cells went off to college. So they could have choices. One choice was to be a secret agent, and the other choice was to be a manager. Now, how many have ever had a really bad manager? How does a bad manager act? Screams at you. It tells you what to do and then tells you how bad you are at doing it. And they never do what? Well, they correct you plenty. You're doing that wrong.
They'll never teach you?
Okay, they'll never help you do it right. So what do you think we might call these manager cells? Helper T cells. Does that ring a bell? Okay, so helper cells. Helper cells, their job is to manage other immune cells. Help them do their job better, just like a good manager. And as it turns out, helper cells get a further choice. They can choose to specialize in either helping macrophages or helping B cells, which we haven't talked about yet. So I'll put B cells on here just so we can show them. So our managers have two types. Type 1, what does type 1 manage? Macrophages. What does type 2 manage? B cells. That makes sense? Okay. Macrophages, you remember what I said, that they're kind of big, dumb, and ugly? Or no, big, dumb, and stupid? So they're kind of directionless. They have to be told what to attack. And what do T cells do? They manage the macrophages and they help them to know what to attack. Does that make sense? Okay. And then B cells, we'll talk about those in a few minutes, need some help as well. And so type 2 cells specialize in helping B cells. So this time what we're going to do is we're going to go over the life cycle of a T cell. So there are 5 major steps in the life of a T cell. Now, every T cell starts off life kind of like a college student, young and naive. So a naive T cell is a T-cell that has never met its purpose in life. How many of you know seniors who are about to graduate and they're like, I have no idea what I'm going to do. I'm going to graduate. Maybe I'll go back to, I don't know what I'm going to do. Nursing students usually don't have that problem because what are you going to do? Well, I'm going to go be a nurse. But, you know, and they got communications. You're like, I don't know, I'm going to communicate. So a lot of times college students don't really know what they're going to do because they haven't found their purpose in life. And what is the purpose of a T-cell? You got nothing. Specific to what? An antigen. So what's its purpose? Its purpose is to find and bind to that antigen and to fight it no matter how it can. So, our T cells start off life naive. Naive T cells circulate through the blood and the lymph, hanging out in little lymph lattes, or lymph cafes, sipping lattes, surfing the internet, texting their friends, waiting to find their purpose in life. Meanwhile, a dendritic cell comes along. I tasted something bad. And it goes up into the lymph node and it says, have you seen this antigen? Do you know this antigen? Do you know this antigen? And when a T cell comes along that recognizes the antigen, what happens? I know that antigen! And the dendritic cell says, kill it. I found my purpose. That is called recognition. So there's two parts to recognition. One is it has to recognize its antigen, but two, it needs to be told a signal to kill that antigen. This is kind of a little bit of a safeguard. In the thymus gland university, if there's a T cell that attacks inappropriate things, the thymus gland is supposed to kill it so that it's not unleash damage upon your body. Like if it reacts to your own self antigens, well, we can't have that, so let's kill it. If it reacts to something like, I don't know, food, well, that'd be pretty bad too, so let's kill it. But every now and then a T cell gets out that it shouldn't get out. So if it recognizes this antigen, but there's no dendritic cell to say, hey, kill it, it'll go and just float around the blood for the rest of his little life in a catatonic state. That's called energy. So in order to be activated, it's got to have a recognition of its antigen and what's called co-stimulation at the same time. And what provides the co-stimulation? The dendritic cell. So that's step number one, recognize. Step number two, what can one little T cell do against all those big viruses and bacteria? Oh, you got to make more of them? Okay, so the fancy word for that is proliferate. The proliferation step is driven by a chemical called interleukin-2. That will come back to haunt us later. So, anyway. Step number three is going to be differentiate. What does that mean? Differentiate is a fancy schmancy word to mean mature. So, it is no longer going to be an immature, naive T cell. It is going to become a fully mature killing machine. Or managing machine, as the case may be. So it'll become its fully developed either secret agent or manager. It'll also make the choice to become a type 1 or a type 2, if it's a manager. Then the last step is what's known as effector function, or immune action. So if it's a secret agent, it's going to go out and secret agent. And if it's a manager, it's going to go out and manage its little heart out. Now, we've won the battle, we've fought back the evil viruses, and we have all these veteran T cells hanging around. We don't really need them. There's no VA system for the T cells. What are we going to do? Kill them? Really? That's how we treat our veterans? Well, actually, fortunately, because you'd die if you didn't. But, so yes, we're going to kill most of them, but a few of them are going to stick around. They're not going to die. What are those ones that don't die called? Memory. Now, memory T cells are fully developed, ready to kill T cells. So the next time this same antigen comes around, we don't need to do steps 1, 2, 3. All we need to do is proliferate and then effector function. We don't have to wait for recognition. Does that make sense? Alright, so that's how a T cell goes. Now let's talk about how B cells are a little bit different. Now, B cells don't get a choice in life because they didn't go to college, so they have to stay home and get factory jobs. Well, it's not exactly true. They don't get factory jobs, they become factories. They actually become little factories that make what? Antibodies. So, B cells produce antibodies. Now, they go through a very, very similar process, but it's ever so slightly different. So, under recognition for T cell, what is it that provides the co-stimulation for a T cell? A dendritic cell. What presents the antigen in the first place? Then that's what it uses to inspect cells. But in order to recognize what cell presents it? Dendritic cells. So a dendritic cell provides the co-stimulation and does the presenting. Now, with a B cell, it's a little bit different. So let's imagine for a moment that we have our little viral cell here, multivalent. And here we have our giant B cell. Now, this B cell recognizes ears. So if it binds to an ear, what's it going to do? You don't know? Stop. Freeze. Don't do anything. Is that what it's going to do, or is it going to do something? It's probably going to do something. All right, so what it's going to do, it's going to stick to it, and it's going to pull the whole thing inside. So now here you've got, by the way, this is actually an antibody that's stuck out of the membrane. It's called a membrane antibody, IgM. By the way, we haven't mentioned the word Ig yet. What does Ig stand for? Immunoglobulin. Globulin is a kind of a protein, and immuno because it's immune action. So, this particular kind of antibody is called IgM because it's sticking out of the B cell's membrane. So, we suck the IgM antibody inside with our little virus attached. And now, it's going to digest the virus. It's going to chop it up into little pieces, and then it's going to display it on the outside. So we've got little triangle ears there, we got little eyes there, and we got little noses there. So how many types of antigens are sticking out of this thing now? Three. Now, B cells and macrophages have a different kind of MHC. They don't have MHC1. Well, they do, but they also have MHC2. And MHC2 is what your T cells use to bind and inspect. And, we forgot to mention, their badge is called CD4. So the CD4 membrane protein binds to MHC2 and allows the T cell to inspect it. Now, what if there were no T cell in your body that can recognize ears? What would happen? Can we never produce antibodies against ears? Or do you think there's a way? How many of you have seen Jurassic Park? Nature will find a way. So there's a way for us still to activate this B cell. And as it turns out, a T cell that recognizes noses can activate this B cell. A T cell that recognizes eyes can activate this T cell. And one that recognizes ears. So there's three potential different kinds of T cells that can activate that one B cell. Does that increase the chances that that B cell will be activated? Does it increase the speed in which it will probably be activated? So this little process where it sucks it in, chops it up, and now multiple T cells can activate it is called linked recognition. So linked recognition is different than T cell recognition in two ways. What are the two ways? First of all, what does the presenting? In the case of a T cell, another cell presents the antigen. In the case of a B cell, the B cell itself presents the antigen to what? A helper T cell. What does the activating in the B cell's case in linked recognition? The T cell. So in a T cell recognition, the T cell is being asked, do you recognize this? Yes, I do. Okay, kill it. In the B cell is saying, hey, I want to kill this thing here. Do you recognize any of these? If you do, I can kill it. Does that make sense? So it's a little bit different, but similar. Now, the next two steps, proliferation and differentiation, are a little bit different for a B cell. Is there anyone in here who's good at drawing? Anyone? One person? How do you typically draw something? Do you just start off and like draw it? Or do you start off with like a little sketch that doesn't have a lot of detail? And then you fill in some details, then you shade it, and then you add in some highlights. Which of those two processes do you think is more common? What? Second one. So you start with a little sketch. Sometimes the sketch doesn't even look like anything. I remember when I was a little kid, I wanted to learn how to draw horses. So I got a book on how to draw horses. You know what it has you do? It has you draw circles. Does that look like a horse to you? Well, now you connect the circles. Does that look like a horse to you? Oh, I got to draw another. And then you erase the circles. Now you have the outline of a horse, right? Okay. So as you go along, it looks more and more like a horse. Now, this is important because the very first antibody produced, what's it called? What was that antibody that sticks out of the membrane called? That is complement cascade. IgM. M for membrane. So that very first IgM is a very low quality antibody. It doesn't stick very well to antigens. What's that theory that we think that they use to stick? Was it? Lock and key. So imagine for a moment that the surface of the epitope looked like this. Okay. And maybe our very first antibody, the receptor portion of it looks like this. Did that wrong. Looks like this. So can it stick to that part right there? But does it stick to the rest? So it's not very sticky. What if we had one that looked like this? Would that be more sticky? What if we had one that looked like that? Would that be even more sticky? And then what if we added in a piece that looks like that? Even stickier, right? So every time we add a little bit of detail, we increase its ability to bind to that epitope. That ability to bind is called affinity. So IgM is low quality, low affinity. So what are little T cells going to do? Here's the B cell, here's the T cell. So B cell, T cell. The T cell is going to go, okay, B cell, divide. So it's going to go, okay. All right, we've divided, now what? All right, you up top, I want you to start producing antibody. I know it's crappy, but it's better than nothing. You three, let's see what you got. Mutate and see if you can do better. And then it goes, you suck, you suck. All right, you're okay. You replicate again. All right, mutate. Let's see what you got. Die, die, die. Nah, you're okay. All right, mutate again. All right, yours is terrible, yours is terrible, yours is terrible. Hey, you're pretty good. Let's use yours. Does that make sense? So, very early on, we've allowed some to produce low-quality IgM. And then, we've done this mutating process to get good quality, high affinity antibodies. And that is called maturation, affinity maturation. So steps 2 and 3 are a little bit kind of linked together in the case of a B cell. And what is directing that affinity maturation process? The T cell. So the T cell is directing this process. Does that make sense? All right. Now, at the end of maturation process, maturation, affinity maturation, there's going to be something called isotype switching. So there's 5 different types of antibodies. IgM, IgD, which... Anytime we don't know what something does, we say it has no purpose. So, IgD has no purpose. What does that really mean? It might have one, but we don't know what it is. So, it's worthless. IgG, IgA, and IgE. So, let's talk about each of those real quick-like. IgG, IgA, and IgE. Alright. IgG is very, very good at neutralizing and opsonizing. I guess I should tell you what the four functions of an antibody. First one is neutralize. What does that mean?
Destroy.
Close. Imagine for a moment that someone's trying to assassinate the president. What would all of the Secret Service people do? Well, they protect the president and then they grab the guy, right? So, imagine for a moment someone had a knife. How would you make sure that the knife can't hurt someone? Everyone grabs his hand, right? Right? Grab him, grab the guy, give him a noogie, and then neutralize him. So, when they bind to the antigen, so it can't harm something, that's called neutralize. Opsonize, what's that? Anyone? Bueller? Bueller? You've never seen Ferris Bueller's Day Off either, have you? Okay. So, what is opsonize? Look back under complement cascade. It's painting the cell for destruction by a macrophage. So, the first one is neutralize. Yeah, we're running out of room. So, neutralize. Second one was opsonize. Third one is activate complement. And the fourth one complement. And the fourth one is increase inflammation. All right. Now, IgG is incredibly good at neutralizing and opsonizing. Type 1 helper T cells are very good at producing high affinity IgG because it helps macrophages. So, type 1 promotes IgG. Type 2 promotes IgE, which has an enormous inflammatory response because IgE, remember, inserts itself into eosinophils and mast cells. When an epitope activates that IgE inside the mast cell or eosinophil membrane, it causes that cell to degranulate, causing an enormous amount of inflammatory reaction. Does that make sense? So IgE is really good at increasing inflammation. IgA has a special property, which you get two antibodies that are stuck together. Now, if you take a molecule and you stick it, a whole bunch of them together, what do you call that? A whole bunch of exactly the same molecule stuck together, what do we call that? What's the Greek or Latin for many? Not multi, the P one.
Poly.
And it's a molecule, so it's a polymer. You may have heard that term sometime in the past. Now, when there's just two molecules stuck together, what's the Greek for two? Dimer. So this is called a dimer. And it has the special ability that it can cross membranes. So it can cross into your eyes, it can cross into your stomach, it can cross into your lungs, and it can cross through the placenta, maybe not the placenta, it can cross through breast milk. So a little baby can get antibodies from his or her mother. So the purpose of IgA is to cross membranes. So what's the purpose of IgG? Neutralize, opsonize, helps macrophages. Stimulated by what kind of helper cells? T helper 1 cells. IgE, really good at producing inflammation because it attaches to eosinophils and mast cells. And the production of IgE is stimulated by what kind of helper cells? Type 2 helper cells. And then IgA has a special purpose, and what does it do?
Inflammatory.
It forms
dimers
which can
cross
membranes. Alright, so we've got four functions. We've got three types plus IgM over here. IgM is crappy. What's its purpose? Something's better than nothing. At the end of this affinity maturation process, what do we get? One or more of high quality antibodies. Each has their own unique function. Now, on the test, when I say list the four functions of antibodies, that doesn't mean list the four types of antibodies. What does it mean? List the functions. If I want to know the types, then I would say list the types of antibodies. So make sure you read the question carefully. Because if you answer the wrong way, I'm not going to go, oh, you're so smart. I'm going to go, you don't know the answer. That's why you're just writing whatever. All right. The effector function is the same, except instead of agenting or helping, it's going to
make antibodies.
Right. And then once the infection is gone, most of them commit apoptosis, and the ones that are left over become memory cells. All right. Now, let's put this all together. Say that again? If I said cells, I meant four types of antibodies. Yeah. You need to know the four types of antibodies, and you need to know the four functions of antibodies.
The types of IgE?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So for those of you who can't hear in the microphone, the question was, so those are the IgEs? Yes. IgM, IgE, IgD, or sorry, IgG and IgA. All right, so now what we're going to do is we're going to draw some connections. So over here we have immunity, which is specific. Over here we have inflammation, which is non-specific. Now, what starts the specific? A dendritic cell. So a dendritic cell is going to come over here and activate a T cell. Right? T cells are going to then in turn manage macrophages, and they're also going to manage B cells. I erased that by accident. B cells are going to produce antibodies, which in turn help direct macrophages and help activate complement cascade. And the complement cascade then helps macrophages do its job better. You need me to move aside so you can take a picture? It's a masterpiece, isn't it? Yeah. It's beautiful. I'm not done yet. Alright. Now, we got to talk a little bit more about B cells and antibodies before we're done. So, a fully mature B cell that is ready for effector function has a special name, and that special name is plasma cell. Someone want to move around so we can have our light back, or whatever. So, what is a plasma cell? A fully mature B cell. So, when a memory cell happens, when it survives the apoptosis culling, what is that called? What is a memory cell technically? A plasma cell. Plasma cells are important for a number of reasons. They're the reason why immunizations work. Now, there's two different types of immunizations, passive and active. What do you think is happening in active? Not necessarily. Could be, but not necessarily. What is your body doing actively? When you receive an immunization, what's the goal of immunization? To make antibodies. So your body will actively make antibodies. How long does an active immunization last? Well, I mean, it depends on the individual immunization, but in the case of like something like measles, how long does it last? 15 years? In the case of hepatitis B, how long does that last? 20 years? In the case of tetanus, how long does that last? 5 to 10 years? 10 as long as you don't hurt yourself. Then it's only 5. Okay. So, in the case of flu vaccine, less than a year. So, well, it depends, but it's a relatively long period of time, up to years, decades even. Passive, on the other hand, is where you're receiving preformed antibodies. Someone else made the antibodies, and now we're giving them to you. How long do those antibodies last? A couple weeks, tops 6 weeks. Now, what is the advantage of active immunization? It lasts a long time. What's the advantage of, but what's the downside? How long does it take to happen? So it can take a while. It can take up to 6 months sometimes before you get really protected. What's the advantage of passive? How long does it take for them to start working? Immediate. What's the downside? Doesn't last very long. And it also hurts like heck. So if you're bitten by a rabid animal, when would you get rabies? About 2 weeks from now. When would the active rabies vaccine start working? About 6 weeks from now. So you're dead before it works. So if you're bitten by a rabid animal, we need to give you preformed antibodies. What if you're bitten by a rattlesnake? When does the poison start working? Right now, immediately. So if we gave you an immunization against it, it wouldn't really help. But what if we could give you preformed antibodies? Have you ever watched the rattlesnake show on Animal Planet or Discovery, whatever it is? What do they do with those rattlesnakes? They go in the desert and they catch them, and then what? They milk their venom, and then they take the venom and what? They inject it into innocent horses. Why a horse? Because they're big and strong. They can take it. And then what does the horse do when it gets venom injected into it? Produces antibodies. Now we take the horse plasma, separate out the plasma, and what do you get? Antibodies, anti-venin, that we can then give to a patient who was unfortunate enough to get bitten by a rattlesnake. Well, most people who are bitten by rattlesnakes are what gender or what sex? Men. And they're usually bitten on the hands. What does that tell you? They're trying to... Yeah. So that's why I say stupid, not unfortunate. Anyway. So... second most common place is on your foot, because you step on it or step close to it. That's unfortunate. On the hands, that's just stupid. But anyway, so that's what passive are. Now, all of the immunizations that we typically think of, measles, mumps, rubella, flu, hepatitis A, hepatitis B, pneumovax virus, varicella, all of those are what kind of immunization? They're all active. Are you going to get this wrong on the test, or are you going to get it right on the test? Right. Oh, I'm getting it wrong, Dr. Heyman. Telling you right now, I want to be wrong. So, most of them are active. What is the purpose of them? To induce your body to make antibodies. Okay. Now we have to talk one last thing, is called a toxoid vaccine. So imagine for a moment that there is a bacteria that produces a toxin that looks kind of like, well, it's supposed to be a dagger. Not a very good dagger, but... okay, so what would this part of the dagger be?
The handle.
What would this be? The blade. Now, to quote another movie you probably haven't seen... do you know how the thing works? Yes, the pointy end goes into the other man. So, what part of this hurts the person? The pointy end. So, what if we produced a chemical that had no pointy end? It was all handle. Would it be dangerous? No. But if we made antibodies against this, when you got infected with the real thing, you would have antibodies that attack this, and they would neutralize it before it could really cause any problems. Does that sound like a good idea? Okay, so this little portion without the damaging end is called a toxoid. And the most common use of toxoid vaccine is in tetanus. So when you get a tetanus vaccine, you're not being injected with dead bacteria, you're being injected with harmless toxin. Does that make sense? All right, that is it for immunizations for the moment. We'll talk more about immunizations in other places. But all right, next we've got a few things I always like, where do we go from here? There's like several places we can go. So let's put them down. I'll let you choose which one you want to do next. Within reason. All right, so one thing we have to do is wound healing. That'll be last. You get no choice on that one. Sorry. We've got to do some drugs sometime in here. And we need to do tests, like inflammation or immune tests. And we also have to do hypersensitivity reactions. Or allergies. Same diff. Tivity. All right. Which one do you want to do first?
Are we doing all of them?
Yep. Hypersensitivity for $400. All right. So a hypersensitivity reaction is an allergic reaction. Now, we already talked about allergic reactions in Unit 1 of this course. What is the definition of an allergic reaction? An inappropriate immune response. And as it turns out, there are at least four mechanisms that we know of, and those are termed hypersensitivity reactions. And conveniently, they are numbered 1 through 4. But they also have names. And so for the test, you need to know the number, the name, the mechanism, and at least one example. Think you can handle that? No. So type 1 reactions are also called vasoactive. They have three names, actually. Anaphylactic type and histaminergic. Whew! Now, they're called vasoactive because, well, they're called histaminergic because the major mediating inflammatory mediator is called histamine. Histamine causes vasodilation, which is why they're called vasoactive. And its most severe form, it can actually cause anaphylactic shock, which is why it's called anaphylactic type. Any questions there? So, the mechanism. You produce IgE antibodies. Those insert themselves into eosinophils and mast cells. When the IgE is stimulated by its antigen, it causes the mast cell and the eosinophil to degranulate, releasing large numbers of inflammatory mediators, the number one of which is histamine. That in turn is going to cause swelling, itching, and other inflammatory problems. So in its most severe form, it can cause anaphylaxis. Some examples would include bee stings, ...10% of food allergies. But these are the food allergies that are dramatic. So if you've ever seen the movie Hitch, we've already established that you should watch the movie Hitch. When his face swells up from eating shrimp, that's type 1 allergic allergy. The reason why when you went to school you probably weren't allowed to bring peanut butter sandwiches anymore, which is kind of silly, is because there are some people who are so allergic to peanuts that if they eat it by accident, or if they're like, here, let's trade sandwiches, they can die from an anaphylactic reaction. So that when I say dramatic food allergies, we're talking about the ones that will make you swell up, you get rash all over your body, or you will die. That makes sense? Okay. Asthma is also an example of this. And nasal allergies. So if you have like seasonal allergies, or if you're allergic to dust or mold where your nose gets all inflamed and you can't breathe, that's also the same type of allergic reaction. Any questions about type 1? All right. Type 2 is called cytotoxic. And what you get is antibodies that are produced against your own body. Now, this one has been kind of a disappearing category. And the reason that it's been disappearing is that in order to get an antibody, you first have to have some other kind of immune reaction first, right? Like a T cell. So what we're doing is we're beginning to shift things out of this category into another category that's T cells. So if you listen to the very, very old podcasts that I made, I give some examples of things there that would be considered type 2 that were no longer considered type 2. So really, probably the only one I can say for certain is type 2 only is would be considered like transfusion reaction. So if you get the wrong blood type, the antibodies against that blood is what causes the reaction. Another example would be if a mother is Rh negative and her child is Rh positive, that reaction would be a type 2 reaction. All right, next we have type 3 reactions. This is called immune complex. So what we're going to get is we're going to get an antibody and an antigen stuck together. And what is one of the purposes of antibodies? If you don't remember one, what's all four? Yeah, let's go all four. Neutralize. Oxidize. Activate complement and increase inflammation. So, wait a minute. Complex. I've heard that word before. Where did you hear it before?
Antibody antigen complex,
which is one of the classical pathways to activate complement. So what happens is you have an antibody antigen complex that activates complement. And the complement cascade causes a large amount of inflammation, and that inflammation begins to damage the body. So inflammation is supposed to be helping, but in this case it's hurting. What's it called when you try and hurt someone, but you hurt someone else instead? What's that called? It's a military term. Collateral damage. How many have ever been next to someone who's fighting? Like maybe you had brothers and you're in the car and they're hitting each other and one of them moves and they hit you instead. Collateral damage. Okay. So the complement cascade is not trying to damage your body. It's trying to damage this immune complex. But the inflammation hurts you. One of those examples of that is rheumatic fever, which we talked about with strep throat. So the antibodies that attack the streptococcus bacteria end up causing the activation of complement cascade, which in turn is what causes all those other problems. So that streptococcus bacteria can stick to the inside of your heart, the endocardium, and to the valves. And then when the complement cascade comes along and causes inflammation there, it can destroy the valve. It can do the same thing with your kidneys, causing something that's called post-streptococcal acute glomerulonephritis, which can lead to acute kidney failure. So that would be one example of immune complex. So it's complement cascade. So some examples here would include acute rheumatic fever, Stevens-Johnson syndrome, which we talked about for antibiotics, and also 90% of food allergies. Celiac disease. There's a whole bunch of them that are caused by this immune complex. Now, here's a fun little story. What if you're so allergic to a food that you could die from an anaphylactic reaction? What is one possible treatment?
Allergy shots.
Well, how do allergy shots work? What do? They actually give you tiny amounts of the antigen. Wait a minute. They to treat your allergy, they give you the antigen that causes the allergy, Dr. Heyman? Yep. Does that make you less allergic? Nope. But what happens is, hopefully, you switch from type 2, which produce IgE, to type 1, which produce IgG. And so that switches you from a type 1 reaction, which could kill you, to a type 3 reaction, where you just kind of feel bad. Most food allergies, they don't necessarily know they have it. They just know, like, when I eat certain foods, I just don't feel right. My stomach's upset. Ugh. They don't realize, oh, I actually have an allergy against that food. Does that make sense? Okay. The last kind is type 4. And this is called cell-mediated. Now, anytime you hear the word cell-mediated, the first thing should pop into your head is T-cells. So T-cells are directing an attack against your own body or against something that causes a reaction in your body. So an example of this would be contact dermatitis. Is anyone here allergic to latex? Well, if you were, that would be contact dermatitis. The latex causes T cells to attack it in your skin, and that causes an inflammatory reaction on your skin. Anyone here allergic to cheap jewelry? Yeah, so when you wear cheap jewelry, you get inflamed in that area, and the reason for that is T cells are attacking that base metal in the cheap jewelry, which is then causing inflammation in your skin. Another example is the transplant rejection. Type 2 diabetes mellitus and myasthenia gravis. Like how I can write two lines at the same time? Did you notice that? No. No, we're too busy writing ourselves, Dr. Heyman. So, anyway, so these are some common examples of type 4. Any questions about that? All right, let's talk about tests. So how does a person know they have inflammation in the first place? Well, you've got your four classic signs and symptoms, Dr. Heyman. Okay, how else could you know? Have we already talked about a lab value that you can check and see if it's high, then that means you have inflammation? Mm-hmm. What was it? Mm-mm. Okay, well, white blood cell count by itself could be a sign. The most common cause of white blood cell count being elevated is infection. But it's not always. It can sometimes be a sign of an autoimmune disease or other immune issues. So that's not always infection, but the most common. What else? Okay, neutrophils and bands, sure. But I was actually meaning something else. We kept using this non-specific word. It's not infection, it's inflammation. What lab value was it? It was written right here, in fact. Earlier, this very lecture. But you see, Dr. Heyman, that was before we took a break. And when we took the break, when we flushed, all the knowledge went down along with the water. It was one of the classical pathways of activating complement cascade. And it wasn't the first or the third.
Highly sensitive CRP.
Well, CRP. Yeah. What's the purpose of highly sensitive CRP? Detecting arterial inflammation. So, but for just ordinary, do you have inflammation or not, you can check CRP levels. So that would be another example. Another one would be fever. And you can also check IgM and IgG levels. Now this one's a little bit important. Which of those is produced first? IgM or IgG? IgM. So during an infection, IgM levels go up pretty fast. Because remember, something is better than nothing, right? But then, as the IgG takes over, what you're going to see is going to look like this. And this is your IgG levels. Now, how many of you got the varicella vaccine? And how many of you got chickenpox? Now, how do we know that you're immune to chickenpox? You check your blood for what?
Resistance.
Not resistance, for immunity. What provides that immunity? Yeah. All right, well, let's hold on for a second there. All right, so you had an infection, you fought it off, and then what happened?
Memory cells.
All right, so what would a memory B cell do? A plasma cell. What would it produce? Antibodies. And what kind of antibodies would it produce? Crappy low affinity or good high affinity? And what's the good high affinity called? I'll give you a hint. It's on the board right now.
IgG.
So, when we want to know whether a vaccine works or whether you are immune from having had an infection, we look at IgG levels. If a person has an infection and you want to know, is this an acute infection? Is this a new onset? Or have they had this for a while? You can look at the ratio of IgM to IgG. If IgM is high and IgG is low, what does that tell you? If IgM is high and IgG is low, what does it tell you about the time? It's a relatively new infection. If IgM is really low and IgG is high, what does that tell you? The exposure has gone on for a while or their immunization worked. Does that make sense? Now, here's a fun little story for you. Most people nowadays are getting their hepatitis B vaccine when they are babies. The reason behind that is not pertinent to today. When we get to healthcare policy, we'll talk about that. But what we've been beginning to find is that it only gives you immunity for about 20-ish years. And that's just in time for you to do what right now? Go to nursing school. Why do we make you get a Hep B vaccine in the first place? Is it protect your patient? Or is it to protect... Oh, crap. It's to protect you. What does that mean? Is that the moment where now you need it the most is the time where it's beginning to go down. So, in the future, we might be requiring titers or IgG levels on everyone. Because if they're down here, well, they might not be immune anymore. So what would you need at that point? Another immunization. So you need a booster to go back up again. That's one of the fun things we've been learning over the years. So IgM and IgE is another thing we can use. And there's something else that we need to look at that's called... Oh, by the way. When you look at IgM and IgG, you're looking at specific IgM and IgG. So it's the IgG against a particular antigen. It's not all IgG in your entire body. Does that make sense? Okay. So next we have something called ESR, erythrocyte sedimentation rate, also known as sed rate. Now, what does the word sedimentation mean? Well, we'll start with the easy one. What is an erythrocyte? It's a red blood cell. What is sedimentation?
Separation layers.
How many have ever been to the beach? If you go go in the shallow water where the waves are breaking, and you get some of the water. Is there sand in that water? Is there sand floating in the water where the water is like turgid and right where the water breaks? Yeah, there's sand in the water. And then if you hold that glass of water, what will happen to the sand? It'll settle to the bottom. What's that called? Sedimentation. So sedimentation is when particles drop to the bottom. So red blood cells, are those particles? Yeah, they're small particles, but they're particles. And if you leave blood alone, what'll happen? They'll settle to the bottom. So if you measure how long that takes, that is called erythrocyte sedimentation rate. How long does it take for red blood cells to settle to the bottom? During inflammation, there are some products that are produced that cause red blood cells to stick together. So a heavier particle sinks faster than a smaller particle. Does that make sense? So those larger particles settle faster, meaning that the rate is faster. So an elevated ESR is a sign of? No! Inflammation. Now, one day, you kids are going to stop saying infection, you're just going to say inflammation. Hopefully that day is on the test. So ESR is a sign of inflammation, but not necessarily infection. So it's what word?
Inflammation.
I know, the descriptive term. Ashley? What descriptive term?
Non-specific.
What? Yeah. So, non-specific. There are some other things you can also measure. For example, if you're looking for autoimmune diseases, you can check what's called anti-nuclear antibodies, which are very common in some autoimmune diseases. And you could also look for RF factor, rheumatoid factor, which is common in rheumatoid type diseases. So there's a bunch of different things you can learn besides that, but these are some of the big ones that you really need to be aware of when you go to the hospital. You'll often see them look at ESR rates, CRP levels, and immunoglobulins. Any questions about the tests? All right, now we're coming to my favorite part, drugs. Love drugs. All right, so we'll start at the very beginning. What are the five stages of a T cell's life cycle?
Recognition.
Proliferation. Differentiation.
Effector function.
And memory. What was number two?
Proliferation.
And what chemical drives it? Conveniently enough, it's interleukin what? Two. So in order to make new T cells, and this doesn't matter whether it's naive T cells that have never been recognized or whether you're proliferating already developed memory cells. It doesn't matter. You need interleukin-2. Without interleukin-2, you can't proliferate. Does that make sense? Now, if we had someone who has an inappropriate immune response and we want to lower the immune response by lowering the amount of T cells, what would we do? We'd want to reduce the amount of interleukin-2, right? Well, as it turns out, interleukin-2 comes from a substance called calcineurin. It's a precursor to interleukin-2. And we have drugs that inhibit the production of this thing. That is not spelled right. Calcineurin. Yeah, who cares? Calcineurin? I call it calcineurin, but it's not really urine. It's who cares? So, we have several drugs that can inhibit calcineurin. And by doing that, they inhibit the amount of interleukin-2, which in turn decreases the amount of T cells that are available for immune reaction. The two drugs that you need to know that do that, the first one is the older drug, is called cyclosporin. And the newer drug, which is still 20 years old at this point, is called tacrolimus. So these drugs are primarily used to treat or prevent transplant rejection, and also used to treat autoimmune diseases. So what is the first autoimmune disease we learned about in this class? Myasthenia gravis. You could use one of those drugs to treat that. Now, because these drugs target T cells, you can also use them for any of your T cell mediated hypersensitivity reactions. So if you take tacrolimus, put it into an ointment and spread it on your skin, you can use that to treat contact dermatitis. So it's kind of weird that the same thing you use to treat poison ivy rash also prevents transplant rejection. But hey, whatever works. By the way, I didn't mention earlier, but poison ivy is a contact dermatitis that's T-cell driven. And there's a certain number of people who, for whatever reason, their T-cells just don't react against poison ivy. So they can rub it on themselves all day and they won't get a problem. Whereas most of us, you just look at it and you get a rash. By the way, never burn poison ivy. The poison is in an oil that is lighter than air and will float on the smoke molecules and get in your eyes. And now you've got poison ivy dermatitis in your eyes. Don't do it. And then it's all over your body. Yeah. And you can spread poison ivy by rubbing and by scratching. So it's just horrifically nasty stuff. Just say no to poison ivy. Anyway, so another drug is called pimecrolimus. You don't even know this for your test, but pimecrolimus is available in a cream form called Elidel, which some of you may have taken at one point for a rash. As far as adverse effects go, the number one adverse effect is going to be low T cell count, which is going to lead to lower immune function. Lower immune function puts the person at risk for what? Infections. It reduces inflammation, but inflammation is part of what helps fight infections. So a patient who's on one of these drugs is at increased risk for infection. There's a number of other adverse effects. Cyclosporin in particular can cause increased fluid retention, and there's a bunch of other stuff. You can read about it. The number one, of course, is increased risk for infection. Next, we have drugs that are called cytotoxic drugs. And these drugs, the way that they work is by inhibiting all fast-growing cells. And if you need to mount a new immune response, what would be fast-growing cells? T cells, plasma cells, neutrophils, all of those would be fast-growing cells. Now, one of the downsides is that they can also target other fast-growing cells in your body, like hair follicles, skin, epithelial cells in your mouth. So some of the adverse effects relate to hair loss, skin erosion, and sores in the mouth. Potentially bleeding, because platelets also need to be produced quickly. And what's the number one adverse effect, though, from a drug that inhibits the immune system? Risk for infection. So, some drugs that do this. The one on your list is azathioprine. And I'll give you two more for fun. Mercaptopurine. And methotrexate. Methotrexate is interesting because not only does it target fast-growing cells in your immune system, it also targets fast-growing cells that are called cancer cells. So it's actually a chemotherapy as well as an immunosuppressant. Pretty cool, huh? You don't seem thoroughly impressed, but you should be. All right. Next, we're going to talk about... Oh, sorry. I don't even remember what is on here anymore. Azathioprine. Yeah. It's on the list. It's on the slides. Okay. So the next type of drugs we're going to talk about are called biologics. Now, these are relatively new. They're anywhere from 10 years old to like last year. And these are a new style of drug. And the concept is not that new. The concept goes back at least 20, 25 years. But these drugs being used in this way is relatively new. And what they are is they are antibodies that are produced against portions of your body's immune system. The number one target for the antibody is TNF-alpha. When I say number one, the majority of the drugs target TNF-alpha. But there are some other drugs that target other things. All biologics end in MAB, which stands for monoclonal antibody. What does monoclonal mean? Mono meaning clonal, meaning clone. So they're cloned against one specific antigen. The specific antigen in most of the cases is TNF-alpha. Okay. So the only drug that I'm going to make you memorize, and so what's interesting is MABs have uses beyond just autoimmune, but the number one use for them right now is autoimmune. If you guys watch TV at all, start looking up the drugs that are on TV, and you'll find that a large number of them are monoclonal antibodies aimed against people who have, or targeted, advertising toward people who have psoriasis, which is an autoimmune disease that causes scaling and itching of the skin. So the one that you guys need to remember is, I can never remember its generic name, it's Adalimumab. Humira is the brand, is it? So that's the one we're remembering is Humira. Number on the test, I'll put both, but for the NCLEX, it'd be better. Well, if you recognize it's a MAB, you know it's a monoclonal antibody. So the number one adverse effect is going to be, what do you think it is?
Increased risk for infection.
So that's biologics. Again, this is a relatively new class. It's an exploding class. There's like dozens of them now. But I'm only expecting us to learn one right now just because, you know, we've already learned so many. What's one more? No, okay. Only one. And that's going to be Humira. Next, we're going to talk about antihistamines. Histamines. Now, antihistamines are typically divided into two categories, first and second generation. So first generation are older, second generation are newer. The first generation typically have more adverse effects. And the number one adverse effect you have to be aware of is drowsiness. And the number two adverse effects you need to be aware of is anticholinergic. So, I think I've boiled down for the test. You only need to remember one, which is diphenhydramine, which is better known by its brand name, Benadryl. So you can give Benadryl IV or PO, and it has a very strong sedating effect on a lot of people, not everyone, but on a lot of people, and it also has quite high anticholinergic side effects. Now, first generation antihistamines are often used in cold preparations. What do you mean by cold preparations? I got nothing. How many of you have ever had a cold? What is the defining characteristic of a cold? Runny nose. What are those anticholinergic side effects again?
Dry as a bone.
Dry as a bone? So when you take Benadryl for a cold, it's not because it's an antihistamine. It's because it's also an anticholinergic. But Dr. Heyman, you didn't make me remember that under the anticholinergic drugs. Well, did you want me to give you another to memorize at that time? Okay, well, there you go. So, when you're taking first-generation antihistamines for a cold, you're really targeting the anticholinergic effects. When you're using them to treat an allergy, then you're using the antihistamine effects. Does that make sense? So, this is probably the number one used in the hospitals at this time. They often give it IV to patients who they think are going to have a hypersensitivity reaction. So, for example, if you need an emergency x-ray with contrast. Contrast sometimes causes an allergic reaction in patients who receive it. So, to prevent them from having an allergic reaction, they would pre-dose them with Benadryl. Or if they started having one, they would give them Benadryl right after that. There's some others that are fairly common. So, for example, doxylamine. Doxylamine is the active substance in NyQuil. How many of you have seen an advertisement for NyQuil? How do they advertise themselves? The sneezing, so you can sleep medicine. Because the number one adverse effect is drowsiness. Another one is called hydroxyzine. And hydroxyzine used to be more common. It's less common nowadays, but it can be given for all the reasons Benadryl can. But it can also be used for patients who have anxiety. So that kind of that sedating effect also reduces anxiety. All right, second generation. So these include fexofenadine, which is better known as Allegra. And then we have loratadine, which is better known as Claritin. Then we have something called desloratadine, which is the active metabolite of loratadine, which is called Clarinex. Then we have cetirizine, which is better known as Zyrtec. Now, want to know something fun about Zyrtec? Hydroxyzine turns into Zyrtec in your body. What does that make cetirizine? Active metabolite. So hydroxyzine is the prodrug of cetirizine. Now, cetirizine has much less drowsiness than hydroxyzine. So if you want the antihistamine effects, you're better off taking Zyrtec. If you want the drowsiness effects, you're better off taking hydroxyzine. So, hydroxyzine has the drowsiness and more anticholinergic effects. Cetirizine has less of that. So, it's more appropriate if you're just treating allergies. Does that make sense? Now, what do all of these have in common? Less what? Less drowsiness, less anticholinergic effect. So if you have a cold, do you want to be taking Allegra or Claritin? If you have a cold, what do you want? You want a first generation. Does that make sense? All right, any questions about those? Now, I should also mention that there's yet another drug called levocetirizine, which is the left hand of cetirizine. What do you mean by left hand, Dr. Heyman? Oh, I'm glad you asked. Take your hands like this. What do you see? They're the same. All right, now, take out a piece of paper and draw a hand turkey. It's a beautiful hand, isn't it? I don't think I've ever seen a better looking hand in my life. Now, take your other hand, try and put it in there. It doesn't fit. Why doesn't it fit? They're exactly the same. See? If they're the same, how come it doesn't fit? What's wrong with me? What's the answer? You were supposed to answer. I wouldn't have had to say that if you'd answered. Why doesn't it fit? Because they're symmetrical, but mirror images. You guys have never seen a mirror, have you? That was before your time. So, most drugs are what they call a racemic mixture, which means you've got left and right mirror images of the drug molecule. Typically, only one of them actually does anything. The other one just interferes or sometimes causes adverse effects. Sometimes, the mirror image is toxic, so you can't even have it at all. So when they first made cetirizine, cetirizine was racemic. It had left and right hands together. And then we discovered only the left hand does something. So if you take out just the left hand molecule, the levo part, and you get rid of the dextro part, the right-handed part, you have even less adverse effect and works even slightly better. So that's what levocetirizine is. Any questions about that? Welcome to stereochemistry. All right. You guys should have learned that in chemistry. Did you guys talk about that in chemistry? Did you take chemistry here? Yeah? You don't remember?
You probably heard the story of our chemistry.
Oh, you had a different chemistry class. Never mind. All right, enough said. But had you taken the normal chemistry here, you would have learned that. All right. Well, now, we have one last class to go. And then we're going to do wound healing. We'll be all done. What time is it?
5 till 4?
We might go slightly long. Okay. So, the important thing in here now is we're going to talk about steroids. You know what? Let's stop here. We'll talk about steroids next time. All right. Any questions before we go about anything we've talked about yet today? All right. Get out of here.